enacting new economic policies or sending aid to Kyiv will be put in jeopardy for the foreseeable future over these results. It is hard to square this reality with the general attitude emanating from the White House that somehow Democrats actually won anything. They outperformed expectations relative to the most recent polls that came out prior to the election, but they still lost the House. This does not legitimize the president or his agenda, but indicates sufficient disagreement with it to change the power dynamic in Congress. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be looking at the recent elections in occupied Palestine, where there was a surge in support for the far right. The settler movement and its ultra-racist supporters have been jubilant about the outcome of the election. But is their hubris misplaced? Could the outcome of this election actually undermine the future of the Zionist colony? We'll be hearing from experts to get their thoughts on this issue after this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra about the Knesset's new far-right parties.
He's back. Benjamin Netanyahu, the war criminal mired in corruption allegations, is back at the helm of the temporary entity. The last time he was prime minister, over 3,500 Palestinians were killed by Israeli occupation forces, including 799 children and 342 women. His rule led to the destruction of over 8,000 Palestinian homes, leaving over 12,000 homeless. This time, though, he has some new allies with him. The alliance includes parties like Jewish Power, Noam, and Jewish Home. But let's take a look at some of the figures belonging to these parties who are likely to have a prominent position in Netanyahu's cabinet. Bezalel Smotrich lives in an illegal settlement on the lands of the village Kafr Qaddoum near Nablus. He has previously called for Palestinians to either live as servants to the Israelis or be killed. Smotrich is a co-founder of the Regavim organization, which descended alongside armed groups onto the Palestinian city of Lid in the temporary entity to squash the Unity Intifada in May 2021. Ofer Sofer is another figure tipped for big things in the Netanyahu government. He was previously a part of Likud and pushes to increase the military budget and Judaize Palestine. He was previously an infantry major in the Israeli military and will play a key role in the coalition. Almog Cohen is a member of parliament for the Jewish Power Party. He went from the Israeli military to the SWAT team in the police of the Zionist entity. He founded an armed militia to stalk the Palestinians in the Naqab in May of this year. Previously, he published a photo of himself in the military kneeling over a Palestinian father and his two sons with the caption, "Those down there remember what I did in the army." The sadistic caption was accompanied by a winking emoji. Another key ally to the Netanyahu regime is Simcha Rothman from the National Union Party. He has lived in the illegal settlement of Gush Zion and is a part of the Temple Mount movement, which explicitly calls for the destruction of Al-Aqsa. Perhaps the most well-known ally to the Netanyahu regime is Itamar Ben-Gvir, the militant Israeli settler who was spotted recently wielding his gun in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. He is known to have had a picture of Baruch Goldstein in his home, enjoying pride of place. Baruch Goldstein, of course, is famous for his attack, killing 29 Palestinian worshippers in the Ibrahimi Mosque of Al-Khalil in 1994. Ben-Gvir is known to have campaigned as a Kahanist, the movement founded by Rabbi Meir Kahane, whose organization, the Jewish Defense League, is a designated terrorist group in the United States. He was also a member of the fascist Kash Party, which was designated a terror organization by the Zionist entity and even outlawed in 1994. He is now likely to be appointed as public security minister, where he will take charge of the Israeli military, despite being disqualified from enlistment in it because of his political affiliations. Ben-Gvir has even been charged over 50 times in the courts of the temporary entity, so much so that he became a lawyer to defend himself. He has called for the mass deportation of Palestinians and even politicians, which he believes has demonstrated disloyalty to Israel. So, as Zionist fascism escalates in occupied Palestine, so too must the resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David is a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Dan Cohen. Dan is the founder of Uncaptured News, which is a multimedia investigative journalism operation. Along with the Grey Zone founder, Max Blumenthal, Dan was responsible for the 2018 film Killing Gaza. The film documented Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza during the war, chronicled its horrific aftermath. We recorded his contribution earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. We asked Dan if he could provide some context on how these far-right tendencies relate to the Kahanist movement.
The Kahanist movement can't be seen as some sort of aberration or separate ideological current than Zionism. It is the completely predictable and logical outcome of Zionism, of a settler colonial movement predicated on ethnic cleansing, predicated on exploitation of religious symbols for European nationalism. And so the kind of brutish face of Kahanism that we see coming into the fore of the Israeli political process today is something that has long been there and is simply the logical, it follows the logic of Zionism.
David, I mean, we've spoken about the Chabad movement on the show before, haven't we? I mean, how does it intersect, you think, with the settler movement?
Well, the home of the settler movement, the kind of the cockpit of the settler movement, is Hebron. And Hebron was a place which was settled initially by the Chabad movement some centuries ago, I mean, a long time ago, and they've been there ever since, even although many of the Jews were pushed out of Hebron after a massacre in 1929. But so Chabad has been very important to the settler movement in Hebron. And indeed, it's also important in what's called the Hilltop Youth settler movement. So it's said by, for example, Shin Bet, the Zionist intelligence agency, that the Chabad followers are responsible for most, maybe up to 80% of the price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians, which are common in the West Bank.
Well, we then asked Dan about Simcha Rothman from the National Union Party, who's part of the movement that wants to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Simcha Rothman is one of the Israeli politicians who represent a sort of the most modern current of religious Zionism, and it's melding with the Kahanist movement, what used to be the most extreme fringe of that movement. He's one of several politicians that now embody the spearhead of Zionism today. You could look at Simcha Rothman, of course. You can look at Itamar Ben-Gvir. You can look at Bezalel Smotrich. All of these are figures who have risen from the fringes of the most extreme right wing of Israeli society and Israeli politics, and are now prominent politically and are unabashed in their goals, their stated goals, to destroy the Al-Aqsa compound, expel all Palestinians, and build a so-called third Jewish temple in its place.
David, I mean, what's the significance of Ben-Gvir's activities in the occupied Palestine neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah?
Well, he lives near Hebron, so not near Sheikh Jarrah. I mean, it's 30 miles or so away. But he's been trying to provoke confrontations in Sheikh Jarrah, so he's been trying to set up an office. He's been appeared there on a number of occasions, most recently with brandishing a gun, but it's not the first time he's been brandishing a gun in the neighborhood. So the idea is to heighten the contradictions, to create a provocation, which then leads to a conflict, which the police or the IDF are then involved.
Well, we also asked Dan about how we should understand Ben-Gvir and his supporters.
Itamar Ben-Gvir is a man who celebrated the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. He is on video saying that they stole the emblem off of his vehicle and that they would eventually get to Rabin as well, which, of course, was done. Rabin was assassinated. Itamar Ben-Gvir venerates the mass murderer, Baruch Goldstein, who assassinated, who murdered 29 men and boys and injured many others when he opened fire in the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So he is a man who venerates mass murderers. But what is the fundamental difference between venerating that mass murderer and what mainstream Israeli society does, where you have monuments and streets named after the terrorist groups of the Etzel and Lehi and Haganah, the pre-state Zionist terror groups that paved the way for the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing in 1948. Those figures committed ethnic cleansings that and crimes that were much more severe, frankly, in terms of quantity, than even Baruch Goldstein did in the Ibrahimi Mosque. So, again, Itamar Ben-Gvir cannot be separated from Israeli society and Zionist ideology that he comes from.
Well, David, I mean, what do we know about Ben-Gvir's actions around the assassination of the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin?
Well, mere days before Rabin was assassinated, he wasn't even 20 at the time.
No.
He was involved in stealing a part of the Prime Minister's car and brandishing it on the television and saying, "We got to his car. We can get close to him." It's a kind of a deliberate, definite death threat, effectively, against the Prime Minister. So you can see the kind of waters in which this politician is swimming. He is there to provoke, there to outrage, and he's been, in many of the court cases, he's been involved in defending people who have been involved in really vile ethnic cleansing attacks. So a key example is the Douma attack, where a Palestinian family were burnt to death, including an 18-month-old child. And he, of course, defended the people involved in that, and he's defended many other people who are involved in terrorism, ethnic cleansing, deliberate attacks against Palestinians. So that's his politics.
No, indeed. Well, thanks for that. I mean, let's just pause there for a moment. This report on the decline of the so-called left in the Zionist entity and what it means for the future of the Zionist colony.
The election bringing Benjamin Netanyahu back to power highlights the rightward drift of politics of the entity. As a result, the Zionist so-called left has been totally marginalized, probably terminally. Labour, the party of First Prime Minister David Green, later known as Ben-Gurion, the Polish settler colonists gained only 4 seats, and Meretz, the party of the secular kibbutzim, didn't even make it into parliament. Labour and Meretz won a combined 44% of the vote back in 1992, the year Yitzhak Rabin was elected, and launched the so-called peace process with the Palestinian. It hit 13% in 2009, now it's down to just 7. Of course, the term left is meaningless in the Zionist entity. The leftist Zionists were at the forefront of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in 1948, and provided the cutting edge of the kibbutz system. Many in the West have wrongly seen the kibbutzim as socialist experiments, but there were always racist endeavors, admitting only Jews and built on stolen Palestinian land. The idea of right versus left blocks in the Knesset is misleading. In fact, when it comes to the Palestinians and the occupation, it is difficult to distinguish the right from the left. It was David Ben-Gurion who, after all, argued directly for the Nakba. We must expel the Arabs and take their places, drive them out. We must do everything to ensure they, the Palestinians, never do return. Today, justification for ethnic cleansing and genocide are rife across the Zionist political spectrum, from the left to the right and the far right. Here are some examples given by the journalist Ben White. I do not think that Arabs want peace. What I want is to be rid of them and to maintain a Jewish majority in the land of Israel. Only the strong winds and parts of Gaza were sent back to the Stone Age. I'm happy to be a fascist. Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and them alone. None of these statements were made by fascist right associated with Ben-Gvir and the other newly elected parties. As the politics of the temporary Zionist entity surges to the right, the end of the Zionist dream is increasingly in sight. Zionism is crumbling from within as it moves ever closer to a new fascism. The Zionists are not a trustworthy or reasonable partner for peace. Even collaborator Abbas of the Palestinian Authority has come to this conclusion. The only option for the Palestinians is liberation. The power of organized Zionism must be broken. The resistance is poised to play its role in destroying Zionism from the outside.
David, that film there was quite revealing. I wonder whether you could say a little bit more about your opinion about the decline of the so-called left in Israel. And also, can you say a word or two about the kibbutz movement? Because, you know, many people in the UK left seem to think that it's been a genuine experiment in socialism. So just give us your thoughts on those two points, would you?
Well, I mean, I think the decline of the left is something which has happened not just as a result of the politics of the Zionist entity, but because of the structure of colonization. They have to move towards the right because the logic of the system is that they have to move towards ending the existence of the Palestinians. That's what the settled colonization of Palestine means. So that's the structural reason why the left really has to decline if they are to carry out their dreams of getting rid of the Arabs. But on the kibbutzim thing, well, you know, it was the left which started up the whole state of Israel, really. I mean, the main military force, the Haganah, was from the left. The right wing revisionist Zionist terror groups were minorities at that stage. The kibbutzim was the kind of cutting edge. The right were kept out of the kibbutzim because they believed in private property, and it was the left who believed in communal living, who were the cutting edge of that, because then it could seem like they all had a stake in this and they could expel Arab labor. So from the very, very beginning, the kibbutzim were Jews only, and the purpose of them being leftist, in inverted commas, was so that they wouldn't have to employ Palestinians. Mm. And there we had apartheid from the very, very beginning, coming through the left, not from the right, not from the revisionists, but from the left. And that's the key thing that mistake people made. Of course, Tony Benn, you saw that in the film, they're doing an introduction, a foreword to that book on the kibbutz. And that was one of the particular, the most left-wing kibbutzims that existed, run by a group called Hashomer Hatzair, which still exists. Of course, Tony Benn later in life became very critical of Israel, but back in the day, he was one of the people who was signed up to that idea that this is a socialist experiment. Never was.
Well, we asked Dan about the difference between the notionally left-of-centre political parties in Israel, like Labour and Meretz, compared to self-styled centrists, Likud, and far-right political parties.
There is no fundamental difference between the so-called left-wing, the so-called centrist, and the so-called right-wing parties in Israel. They are all Zionists, meaning they believe in colonizing the land of Palestine and maintaining its indigenous residents as, at best, second-class citizens or people to be expelled and killed. The only difference is in terms of how they see fit to carry out this project. The so-called Zionist left wants to maintain a more gentle, softer occupation of the West Bank, with Palestinians remaining docile in their sort of enclave separate from Jewish society. And for the Israeli military to be as soft as possible while still maintaining total program of total conquest. The centrists are basically there. I would say there is no, well, the center in Israel is essentially right wing in that it is hyper-nationalist. It believes that there is no compromise with Palestinians, and the center has now been joined by the far right. It has been sucked into the far right because of the so-called left's hypocrisy. The left has in Israel has long said, "Let us just maintain this project. We'll be in conflict with the Palestinians, and we'll just use the military when we need to." But that reeks of hypocrisy for the Israeli right, for the Israeli masses. Why should we be in conflict forever? Why should we deal with suicide bombings or whatever kind of attacks on soldiers and citizens alike? Let's end this. And so they have come to basically agree with the hardcore Israeli right wing that says full ethnic cleansing, full conquest, dismantle the Palestinian Authority, which collaborates with Israel to repress Palestinian resistance, and let's not be hypocrites.
David, what's the background to the radical settler movement that's centered in Hebron?
Well, the radical settler movement is dedicated to taking more and more territory from the Palestinians. In Hebron in particular, there's been a historical dispute going back not almost a century now, over the Ibrahimi Mosque, which is also known to the Zionists as the Cave of the Patriarchs. And this is supposed to be where Abraham and his relatives are buried. So this used to be simply a mosque for Muslims, but it's been, for some years now, it's been a joint-use facility, if you like. So it's half a synagogue and half a mosque. And there's a massive conflict there over that. Of course, Al-Quds, they want to take over Al-Aqsa, they want to take over the Ibrahimi Mosque. Now, there are something like 20 or 30,000 Palestinians in Hebron, and only a much smaller number of settlers. So it's a really focused conflict, and it's been a focused conflict for a very long time, in particular starting in 67 when some of the Zionists, the settlers, came back to Hebron after they'd been expelled in 1929.
Well, we also asked Dan where he thought Zionism was actually heading.
Zionism is reaching its logical conclusion. The hypocrisy of the establishment, of wanting to live a sort of European bourgeois lifestyle, well, the masses are sent to fight in the army and then to come back and live in a kind of neoliberal hellscape where they have no possibility of advancing economically, where they are in a permanent underclass, that has created a gigantic opportunity for the Israeli right to come in and say, no, let's end this. Let's end the conflict with the Palestinians, not by making a genuine peace, which is, of course, what any genuine left would do, but with the Israeli rights program is to finish the job, is to finish 1948, is to finish 1967, and expel all Palestinians from the land, and even the Kahanis, the real ideological force of Israeli society today, not only wants to conquer, not only wants to ethnically cleanse all of Palestine, but even beyond its borders, into Lebanon and Syria, beyond the Golan Heights even, into Jordan, into Egypt.
David, what's the future, do you think, of the Zionist entity, given this continuing move to the right?
Well, I think the structural answer to that question is that it's the same future as every settler colony. Settler colonies either have to, first of all, exterminate the natives, or they have to be broken and defeated. And that's the history of every settler colony, in the US, in Australia, in New Zealand, and indeed in the north of Ireland, where we're in an intermediate case. So the tendency has to be for them, and this is why we see the radical settler movement, they've got to destroy the natives. They've either got to expel all the Arabs or kill them. Yeah. And if they can't do that, that will only be because they are defeated. There are no alternatives. There's no meaningful peace process that can come in between those two alternatives. But as we've seen, the whole of the movement, political movement in occupied Palestine, is to one of those two alternatives. Either finally the defeat of the Palestinians and the Arabs being expelled from the territory altogether, or liberation.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. I hope you found the programme informative. Thanks to our guests, Dan Cohen, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
In the limelight. In the United States, former Vice President Mike Pence has suggested the Justice Department did not try hard enough to obtain the classified and sensitive documents that were taken to former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence before executing search warrant at the property earlier this year. Mike Pence also suggested FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago sent the wrong message. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Former US Vice President Mike Pence has said FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago has sent the wrong message. Though he believes no one is above the law, former US Vice President Mike Pence says he hopes federal prosecutors give careful consideration before they take any additional steps in investigating Donald Trump's role in inciting the rioters who staged the 6th of January 2021 Capitol attack. Mike Pence made those remarks on Sunday, 20th of November, in an interview with the host of NBC's Meet the Press program, Chuck Todd, in which he also said the FBI sent the wrong message with its search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in August to retake government secrets that were stored there without authorization. According to Mike Pence, Donald Trump was repeating what he was hearing from the gaggle of attorneys around him before the deadly 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol nearly 2 years ago, which supporters of the former president at the time launched in a desperate but unsuccessful attempt to halt the certification of his defeat to Joe Biden in the 2020 election. Trump has been under congressional investigation after telling his supporters, some of whom wanted Mike Pence to stop the certification or hang from a gallows, to fight like hell that day, among other things. Joe Biden's Attorney General Merrick Garland on Friday appointed a special counsel to weigh charges against Donald Trump for the Capitol attack and the government's secrets at Mar-a-Lago 2 days after the former president announced he would again seek the Republican Party's nomination for the White House. But when asked on Sunday if he thinks Donald Trump committed a crime in connection with the Capitol attack, Mike Pence replied, "I don't know if it is criminal to listen to bad advice from lawyers who were consulting the president on efforts to sow distrust about his loss to Joe Biden." As for the Mar-a-Lago search, Mike Pence suggested that federal authorities had not exhausted alternative methods to recoup the secret documents in question. there had to be many other ways to resolve those issues, Mike Pence told the host of NBC's Meet the Press, Chuck Todd. The Justice Department had issued a grand jury subpoena seeking all documents bearing classification markings in Donald Trump's possession before the Mar-a-Lago search. Trump's lawyers produced some documents in early June in response to that subpoena, but the Justice Department subsequently received evidence that other classified documents remained at Mar-a-Lago, leading to the search there on 8th of August this year. Ultimately, Mike Pence said it sent a wrong and divisive message, particularly to the wider world that looks on to America. I want to see the credibility of the U.S. Justice Department restored after years of politicization, Mike Pence added. Mike Pence's relatively supportive remarks for Donald Trump cut a contrast with more critical ones that he had leveled against his former running mate in his new memoir, So Help Me God. One part of his new memoir says Donald Trump erred by failing to condemn the 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, marked by a deadly police helicopter crash and the murder of a counter-protester. The book also asserts that Donald Trump misstepped by failing to acknowledge Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election he won over Hillary Clinton, saying that doing so would not have cheapened the victory. Mike Pence also responded to Trump's latest run for the White House by telling ABC News, "I think we'll have better choices in the future." For his part, Mike Pence told ABC News he was giving prayerful consideration to his possibly competing for the Republican nomination too. Authorities have linked up to 9 deaths to the Capitol attack, including the suicides of police officers who were traumatized by having to defend the grounds on that day. More than 800 participants have been charged, including members of the violent far-right groups, and many have already been convicted as well as imprisoned for their roles on that day. Mike Pence said on Sunday, 20th of November, he was proud that neither chamber of Congress let the Capitol attack derail the certification of the 2020 election's outcome. Leaders in both political parties reached unanimous agreement that whatever needed to be done, we needed to reconvene the Congress on that day and finish our work, Mike Pence said. The website of TheHill.com has also covered the same story. Former Vice President Mike Pence suggested the Justice Department did not try hard enough to obtain the classified and sensitive documents that were taken to former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence before executing search warrant at the property earlier this year. Mike Pence told Chuck Todd in an interview on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday that there had to be many other ways to resolve those issues and collect the missing documents. Mike Pence said, "I've not hesitated to criticize the former president when I think he was wrong, and clearly possessing classified documents in an unprotected area is not proper. But I have to tell you, I was on the Judiciary Committee for 10 years in the House of Representatives. I know how the Justice Department works, and there had to be many other ways to resolve those issues and collect those classified documents." Mike Pence added, "They didn't try everything, and I have to tell you, going to the last resort of executing a search warrant against the former president of the United States, I think sent the wrong message. It was a divisive message in this country," he said. Multiple outlets reported that the FBI communicated with Donald Trump's attorneys to try to obtain the missing documents and turned them over to the U.S. government record keepers at the end of his administration. But Donald Trump repeatedly stifled the Department of Justice efforts to reclaim the materials for a period of months before the FBI conducted the search, acquiring thousands of pages of documents from Mar-a-Lago. Mike Pence said the search also sends the wrong message to countries throughout the world who are observing the United States. He said third world countries often see a new leader come into power and prosecute and jail the previous leader. America should never be associated with that image at all, he said. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel on Friday to oversee the investigation into documents found at Mar-a-Lago and the efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election to avoid potential conflicts of interest.
Discovering Islam.
Based on the Islamic teachings, the soul lives after the body is dead and decomposed. Based on the same teachings, the souls will be resurrected in their bodies on the day of judgment. However, the question is, where would the soul go in the interim period between death and the day of judgment? Would they live, or they will be in a state of oblivion? If they live, what type of life they would have? Do they feel happiness and pleasure and pain and agony? What about those souls who have not lived enough to attain merit or demerit? What about the children? What type of life they would have in that interim period? The world of the dead is usually portrayed as the most terrifying realm man has ever imagined, the realm of spooks. We are usually frightened even to think about it. However, based on the Islamic teachings, what comes after death and before the resurrection of the dead is a fascinating world.
The phases of our existence are divided into two. One is called al-dunya, this world, and one is called al-akhirah, what happens afterwards, the hereafter. Dunya is roughly divided into our existence as we walk about on earth and our existence when we lie under the ground. One is dunya, one is barzakh. Both of them are still dunya. They are not akhirah. So we define dunya as everything that happens before the blowing of the trumpet that brings an end to all this life, and that is divided into earthly life and barzakh.
There is the dunya and there is the akhirah. Okay, two very distinct. But there is a buffer world, or a world that in a way is brings the two together. You know, it separates the physical world of the laws of physics and the world of spirits. And the two, you know, because of their very different laws and incompatibility, really.
In barzakh, the souls, if you like, are kept in waiting till the rest of humanity catches up with them, so that then they can enter the new phase of their existence, which is to be arrayed in front of their Lord on the Day of Judgment.
With death, we enter a world of wonders. We will have dreamlike experiences, which is far more different from what we now know.
The awareness in barzakh of an individual, believer or unbeliever, is vastly superior to the awareness of even the greatest scholars who are alive now, because there is an element of certainty in the vision that you have in Barzakh, which is difficult to get in this world.
This stage of our life, or this stage of journey towards the Lord, is called with different names in Islamic literature. It is sometimes referred to as the middle world, or the world of images, Alam al-Mithal, or the barrier world, Barzakh.
Barzakh is a variety of passages into the hereafter.
Something that separates two things is a barzakh. And that's why this realm is called the barzakh, because it divides this life that we live in right now from the hereafter. Although it's a very, very long time in between, nonetheless, since it divides these two from each other and separates them, it has been called the barzakh, where people go.
We call it barzakh because there is an impregnable barrier between that dimension and the dimension in which we live now. It cannot be penetrated back after the soul has passed through it with the help of the angel of death. Now, the Quran states that after they die, behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
The Quran states, and beyond them is a barzakh, or a barrier, before the day in which they will be brought forth. So the Quranic picture of barzakh is some sort of intermediary phase before the major day of resurrection.
Barzakh in Arabic just means barrier, something that separates two things, like we have, for example, in the verse in Surah Rahman, that the sweet water and the salty water have a barzakh between them. And, you know, these waters can travel together without mixing because there is this impenetrable barrier between them. In the same way, this barzakh, the intermediary world, because it is a buffer, if you like, between life and world, life of this world, and the day of judgment. And these are one-way streets. People do not come back from them.
There is a point in the near-death experience that a lot of people mention, in which they have a point of decision, let's say. It could be sometimes a barrier that they are going to pass, or sometimes it's just a perception that if they move on, it's like a decision made, either I come back or I stay. Come back, I mean, to the intraphysical life, to their lives back.
When we talk about the world of graves, we do not talk about the physical bodies buried here, rotten after a while. We talk about a world of a different dimension. We talk about the souls living in the spiritual bodies. Although they are connected to our world, but they live in a completely different dimension.
The grave referring to here, of course, is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave. You might have an individual who may not even have a grave. God forbid someone dies in the sea, and let's say maybe eaten up by the animals of the sea. So he or she may not even have a grave. But what we're talking about is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave.
Where is the soul of this body now? Does it really live inside this? According to our knowledge and according to the traditions that we have been taught, the soul is not related to this body anymore. The soul is living in a spiritual body. This body, whether rotten or kept intact, is of no use anymore.
The question that comes up is, why is it necessary to even have a barzakh realm, a barzakh world that we go to after death? Why not go straight to the hereafter? First of all, there's a fixed time for the hereafter. And in the Quran it says, "Ilmuha inda Rabbi," and the knowledge of the hour is with my Lord. So that has a fixed time, and now we're living in this life. And at the same time, we believe that the soul doesn't die. The body will die, will deteriorate. But the soul is to live on. Okay, so where is it going to be? What's going to happen? Because the hereafter hasn't arrived yet. The day of judgment hasn't arrived yet. Well, that's where it's going to be then. It's going to be somewhere. That somewhere where the soul is residing is called the Barzakh.
What is the purpose of Barzakh? My idea is that, of course, the Day of Judgment is a day when there will be a collective presence of humanity. But humankind comes to the earth and leaves the earth in groups. We don't all come together and we don't all leave together. But on the Day of Judgment, we all have to arrive together, which means that we need a holding area.
In this seir and this traveling towards Allah and movement towards Allah, this soul is developing slowly. They say that the Barzakh is a place where souls are prepared either for the punishment or for the great rewards. In the Barzakh, it is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will sometimes have people compensate for what they missed in this life so that they don't miss out on the good stuff on that side. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have a chance to do good deeds there. That is done. But still, those good deeds that we did in this life, those good intentions that some might have had in this life, will have an effect on their development in the Barzakh.
The traits that we allow our souls to be occupied in, or the dispositions that we form in this world, they become like the seeds germinated within fertile ground. They sprout and they come to the fullness of their existence, just like a baby, through the influence of DNA, becomes a fully grown baby, a fetus, before they arrive into this world. So before we arrive into the next world, we fully mature in accordance with those dispositions that we have brought upon our own selves within this world.
It's in that dimension which question about the past life of every individual buried takes place. And that is the world of the grave. That is Alamul Mithal.
Mithal means image, but not like the image we see in the mirror. Rather, it's an image not dependent on mass and matter, hence more abundant with life and freshness.
Sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, and any other quality that we experience in this world are but faint shadows reflected from that world on the dull face of the matter. A world in which the heaviness of the matter does not slow down the life, just like what we see in our dreams or experience in our imagination.
The pleasure and the pain of that world and the duration of that world can never be likened to this world, because in this world everything is watered down. My fullness of my pleasures cannot come to the fore, nor my pains or my fears, because there are limitations through matter. But in that world there are no limitations.
The spiritual grave could be either a place of garden, heaven, paradise. Someone feels that he or she is receiving the blessings of God Almighty. Or it could be one of the pits of fire where the punishment will constantly endure.
The soul is subjected to confinement, pain, punishment, sickness, and grief, as they are to various states of joy, rest, bliss, and freedom. Now, all these are, of course, experienced in the spiritual body and not by the physical body.
In Barzakh, we would feel pain, sorrow, and happiness, absolutely, because these are aspects that deal with the nafs, and it does not deal with the physical body. Although they say there are some happy hormones in the body, there are some painful hormones in the body, but these would come as consequences, you know. So the soul or the nafs is what feels the pain and the pleasure. And that, since it never dies, it's not the physical body that feels the pain and the pleasure. No, it's reflected on the physical body, but it's actually the soul or the nafs that is feeling it.
The Quran states that the life of this world is just play and sport, and that the real life will come in the hereafter. As the middle world or Barzakh
is one step ahead towards the hereafter. The life there must be much richer than what is experienced here.
The whole context that we understand this world is different over there. And therefore, it's very difficult for that human being. And same thing when the day of resurrection. Everything we know about that world and this world is going to be completely different as well.
This life is seen in Islam and the Quranic vision of Islam as being purely instrumental. It is a means to something much more. Okay, this life is simply a process through which we can start to fulfill the divine potential which is within us, to live beyond the bounds and limits of this material world.
When the souls arrive in Barzakh, they find themselves in a new form of living in which the intensity of life and its dimensions are exponentially increased. The soul in its mythali body is the swiftest thing in moving, relocating, ascending, or descending from one place to another. However, based on the degree of their completion, they can be divided into various categories.
One cannot imagine how exciting the arrival of the soul to that world may be. It's so lush, so astonishing, so glorious, that it leaves the soul to marvel for a long time. It's an experience like the birth of the baby into this world from the womb. Now, the difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, whereas the baby's soul is very astute and can feel the difference.
There is a constant progression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at whatever age we go. The soul is not really bothered with whether it is 20 years old or 200 years old when it leaves the body. It is still very young in the great journey that is yet to come. It is an infant. It's just a case of relativeness. Yeah? Because when you're talking about the Day of Judgment itself being 50,000 years long, and Barzakh, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of years long, 200 years or 2 years old becomes very relative. The soul is still young. It has a lot of maturity and a lot of learning to do still.
By entering into that world, the soul moves one step forward, and its powers to comprehend the realities of existence increase. It is now one stage closer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord.
When the Prophet went to the dead of the Meccans that lay on the battlefield of Badr, he said, "Do you find the promise of God to be true?" The Sahaba said, "Ya Rasulullah, bal amwat." "O Messenger, these are dead people." He said, "No, asma'a minkum wa absar." He said, "No, they hear more than you do, and they see more than you do."
People in Barzakh are of different types, much more diverse than we see in this world. They eat and drink, but not of things of this world, and dwell, but not in places of this world.
Their food and drink and dress, their houses and furniture, their cities and neighborhoods are of diverse and dissimilar kinds. They may be poor or rich, beautiful or ugly, and happy or miserable. They are all based on what they have done in this world.
The Islamic tradition has references to three groups. Group number one, the believers. Again, I stress on the fact, believers, not Muslims. A disbeliever can be a Muslim. The believers who have acted in accordance with their faith, they practice what they preached, those will be enjoying some of the features of heaven in that world. On the other side, the second group, the disbelievers, could be Muslims, are unfortunately suffering from some of the punishments that they will be subjected to in the hereafter, after the Day of Judgment. And there's a third group who some of the tradition describe as they are neither the first group nor the second group. They are a group of people who maybe they were not subjected to enough knowledge. They will be in a state of as if they were asleep. God will just leave them.
For believers, life in Barzakh is going to be fascinating. They live in vast expanses with bespoken landscapes around mansions and palaces furnished with luxurious furniture in their lounges and rooms.
They are served by innumerable some number of servants with inner and outer beauty with no purpose but to serve their masters. Now bear in mind that none of these are physical objects. They all belong to the spiritual world, a world an image of which is reflected in our world.
All these are there to strengthen their love and appreciation for the God they are going to meet after this stage of their life. However, we have to be careful not to confuse this exuberant life with what awaits them in the eternal paradise, as the quality of life there is in no way comparable with what they experience here in the middle world.
We have a basic understanding of what paradise has, the beautiful scenery, the palaces, the service, the gardens. But actually, there's more to it. Meeting the Lord, proximity to Allah, seeing Allah with the heart, seeing God with the heart, is a theme that the Quran encourages people to think about.
Here we need to talk about one other type of life in Barzakh. The life of those who have died at a young age and have not developed into good or evil souls.
Compared to the grown-ups, the children who die at a young age have one advantage and one disadvantage. Now, on the positive side, they are sinless and hence open to any concept and wisdom that the angels may teach them. On the negative side, they have not developed concepts, feelings, and thoughts which are prerequisite for ultimate wisdom.
The views about what judgment will be passed on those who have died at a young age differ. Most Christian theologians believe that only those children who are baptized would attain salvation. The majority of Muslim theologians, however, believe that every child who has died at a young age would be saved.
If a child dies before he has the mental maturity to choose between right and wrong, that child will continue to exist because he was born for eternity, but he will not, of course, be subjected to any judgment because he didn't have the mental capacity to choose.
They can only be taught to a restricted degree, and deeper aspects of wisdom cannot be known by them.
These teachings have two aspects. One, to teach them the wisdom and the knowledge that are prerequisites for entering that realm. And two, to cleanse them from the wrong teachings given to them by their parents or their society that is a hindrance for entering the holy realm.
Their purity is very different from the purity of the grown-ups. It is this latter purity and the depth of wisdom corresponding to it which determine the place of every individual in the final abode.
We have people out there who envy those who die at a young age. They say this child, this youth, he died before getting a chance to sin and before getting the chance to become a bad person. He's so lucky. But if you look at it from Allah's perspective, it's not necessarily something good.
children cannot enter the territory of the righteous immediately after death. They live in a very beautiful interim space under the guidance and training of the angels to prepare them for entering that realm.